You know, it's interesting that you brought up the sunk cost fallacy, because I'm not a huge football fan. I'm just going to put that out there. I'm not a sports fan. I love
me the Nuggets. Either, so I love basketball. Really interesting conversation.
So we're over Christmas break. Like my family, my nephews, my brother, all my brothers-in-law, they're all big Broncos fans. So we're watching the Broncos. And I have been like, Russell Wilson is a classic case of sunk cost fallacy, right? Like the Denver Broncos franchise paid so much money for him, yeah, brought him in, and he's just not the same. I mean, sorry, everybody who's a Russell Wilson fan, but he hasn't brought that same charisma to Denver as he brought to, yep, Seattle. So yep, I was real excited to explain the sunk cost fallacy to my nephews using Russell Wilson as an example. Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's episode of the Framework Podcast. I'm your host, Ana Trujillo-Limon, and today I'm really excited to be joined by my multi-talented colleague, Dr. Julie Ragetz. And Dr. Julie, you have so many expertise, and I'm tapping into all of them for so many topics in the next few months. But this time we're here to talk behavioral finance. So Dr. Julie, welcome back to the show.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, we joked with Dr. Craig Lemoyne that if we need those green jackets or the jackets that people get on Saturday Night Live for many appearances on the podcast. So I think Kelsey and I will work to try to figure that out. Because wouldn't that be awesome? That.
Thank you. Yeah, I could like hang, you know, that would be great. Yeah, it's an honor to be a frequent contributor to Framework. So always happy to be here.
Love it. So it's behavioral finance on Framework. And, you know, I want to thank our sponsors, WisdomTree, for bringing us this stellar lineup of behavioral finance experts, including Dr. Julie. So today we're going to dive into, you know, how firm owners can use behavioral finance theory to make better business decisions. And we're going to talk a little bit about what Dr. Julie wishes y'all would reframe your thinking on when it comes to this topic. So for those of you who haven't had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Julie, tell our listeners a little bit about what you do here at Carson.
Well, great. Well, thanks again for having me. So at Carson, I lead our next gen in advisor development program. So I get to do a lot of wonderful things at Carson. One of them is that I get to work with our advisor, the stakeholders in our advisor development program. So these are college graduates learning really the business. So that's incredibly rewarding and really impactful. So I love that. I also have the opportunity to lead our Women in Wealth research along with Anna and some other amazing folks at Carson. So we get to partner on that, which is really cool. And then kind of apropos to a little bit about what we're talking about today, I also have the opportunity to talk to some of our clients as they're doing their family planning and communicating how they wish their assets to be dispersed after their death. So that's brings in a lot of behavioral elements too.
Oh, for sure. Very critical. We'll dive into that. And we're actually talking about our Women in Wealth next month. So Dr. Julie will be back. We're going to dive into some of the key findings of the report. It's going to be wonderful. So we have tackled this topic together on Framework a few times, hence why you need the jacket, right? So that's why we're going to take a little bit of a different perspective this time, you know, helping firm owners implement behavioral finance theory to build better businesses. So I was reading this article in Forbes that talked about how business owners can use behavioral finance theory to help make better financial decisions. So what are your thoughts on that perspective? And what do you think are some of the ways our partners and other firm owners can kind of do the same?
Well, you know, I think one of the things I was really excited about this is that I did my dissertation research on the history of behavioral finance. And I think it's one thing that we don't have the opportunity to talk a lot about from the context of how that impacts actual decision makers. Mm-hmm. And so one of the challenges that comes along with thinking through behavioral finance is we tend to think that it really just applies to investors. And we tend not to think that it applies to people like us, right, mm-hmm, who clearly wouldn't be susceptible to any of these biases and heuristics in our own decision making. And that's just not true, right? So when we talk about behavioral finance, we talk about the consistent and predictable ways that people deviate from what rational choice theory would predict their decisions should be. And there's a couple of different words there that I want to highlight for just a moment. The first is that it's consistent and predictable. So we all have our idiosyncratic ways of making decisions, right? Like I have my special Julie way of making decisions that takes into account my experiences and my perceptions of reality. You have your special way of making decisions that's unique to you, unique to your history and your experience. But behavioral finance really isn't talking much about that. It's talking about the predictable ways in which we deviate from rational choice theory. So at the outset, everyone is susceptible to these sorts of biases in our decision making. The second thing that comes through with that for me is that it talks about how individuals deviate from rational choice theory. And that's not rationality. Right? So one of the examples when I talk to advisors about the insights of behavioral finance to their clients is that I say it is not irrational to want to stop losses. So if I'm an investor and I'm seeing, my portfolio decrease and decrease and decrease, the most rational thing for me to do is to sell. Like that actually makes sense. I'm ending something that's losing. And so to call that behavior irrational just seems to miss the point, right? So it is against what rational choice theory would dictate, which is not responding to maybe emotional cues. So I think that when you look at it through that broader framework, of, these are consistent and predictable ways of orienting information, that it's almost impossible to avoid them just because of the way we process and intake information. So much information comes into us. How we sort that information, categorize it, and prioritize it to help us make decisions inevitably involves some form of heuristics and shortcuts. The other point is that in being susceptible to biases and heuristics in our decision making doesn't make us irrational in the common sense use of the word. Mm-hmm. That being said, with all that as preamble, I love that you're talking about this, Anna, in the context of reframing, because that would be the first way I would reframe the notion of behavioral finance, is to not look at it as normatively bad. Right? The insights of behavioral finance aren't something we necessarily need to overcome. They don't make us necessarily poor decision makers. They don't make us uniquely poor decision makers. They make us human decision makers. And so reframing kind of the insights of behavioral finance to say something along the lines of, as a human person, I process, extraordinary amounts of information. I tend to make decisions in ways that are predictable and consistent, but that rely on shortcuts and heuristics to make those decisions. And that doesn't make me a poor decision maker or irrational in the common sense understanding of the word. So that's actually how I'd reframe it. Mm-hmm. Maybe from a normatively bad context to maybe a normatively neutral one.
And that's helpful too. I've always been curious to ask this question, so I'm going to ask this of everybody. But in terms of, when advisors and firm owners get more knowledgeable on these types of frameworks and this subject matter area, do you find that maybe sometimes people are like, oh, well, I spot what I'm doing and I know what I'm doing and I can explain it now. But, kind of closing that gap, that behavior gap, like Carl Richards calls it, do you find that that gets more difficult or easier for people the more they know?
That's such a good question. It reminds me, before I came to my first corporate job, I used to study organizational cultures. And I remember reading about a concept, I'm sure you've heard of it, called organizational disengagement, mm-hmm. which is when you just kind of disengage from your job. You're not very motivated. You're not really interested. You're not actively ready to quit, but now we call it quiet quitting. It's mm-hmm. a new term for organizational disengagement, much, much like pithier too, right? I remember once sitting in my office and being like, I am disengaged. Like, this is what disengagement feels like. Like, wow. Yeah. I don't really want to do anything. And for me, that was an enlightening kind of moment where there was a theory to explain why I was feeling the way I was feeling. And I think that in the context of getting familiar around biases, the ideal is that you start to create a counterweight to them. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of behavior gap is you're recognizing it's possible and indeed likely that I'm using a set of shortcuts to make this decision. How can I challenge myself to think differently about this? So the sunk cost fallacy, mm-hmm. which is something that comes up a lot. Which is that, gosh, I've poured money into this project and how do you stop that? And so I'm dating myself here, but there was a movie called The Money Pit with Tom Hanks, which was way before his Polar
Express. I love that movie. It made me not want to buy a house when I was
young. And we all relate to it because it's, and I think what's really interesting is that notion of the sunk cost fallacy, that notion that we can recognize it in the Tom Hanks movie. I think we can, once we understand the definition of the fallacy, we can even recognize it in our own relationships. Mm-hmm. Like, I've certainly had friends and colleagues where why are you still in this relationship? And I was like, well, I've been here for a long time. And I'm like, well, is it going to be any better if you're here for 20 more years? Like, it's a way of thinking about things where we overweight mm-hmm. previous investments. And I think that becoming aware of that fallacy, whether it's even in the movies or in our personal relationships, should give us pause to think through. Mm-hmm. Are there business decisions I'm making, whether they're personnel decisions, which is where a lot of the sunk cost fallacy comes up, where if you ask people if they've let go of a stakeholder that isn't working out, they'll typically say, I'm sure you've heard this a ton of times, right? Well, I knew from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Well, then, why are we still here 24 months from now? And that's that kind of sunk cost fallacy. So I think it can help. I think it can, but it only helps if you think it applies to you. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the big challenge, is for all of us to again reframe our thinking to say, these are not normatively bad. This doesn't make me a poor decision maker or a poor reasoner. It makes me human. Mm-hmm. And I am just as susceptible to this as my client, as my, as my support team, as anyone else.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting that you brought up the sunk cost fallacy, because I'm not a huge football fan. I'm just going to put that out there. I'm not a sports person. I love the Nuggets. I love
basketball. Really interesting conversation.
So we're over Christmas break. Like my family, my nephews, my brother, all my brothers-in-law, they're all big Broncos fans. So we're watching the Broncos. And I have been like, Russell Wilson is a classic case of sunk cost fallacy, right? Like the Denver Broncos franchise paid so much money for him, yep. brought him in, and he's just not the same. I mean, sorry, everybody who's a Russell Wilson fan, but he hasn't brought that same charisma to Denver as he brought to yep. Seattle. So yep. I was real excited to explain the sunk cost fallacy to my nephews using Russell Wilson as an example.
But the thing is that I think you really get to. I think you really hit on something important there, Anna, because the idea is that it becomes a way to explain the inexplicable. Mm-hmm. So when you're sitting there, whether it's Russell Wilson, which I actually totally tend to think that the sunk cost fallacy can explain so many poor franchise decisions across multiple sports universes. Now the examples are populating in my head. You can get that picture of, whether it's a Russell Wilson or whether it's, Tom Hanks and whoever I think it was Goldie Hawn, who might have been his co-star in that movie, kind of literally staring into the sinkhole, physically staring in the sinkhole. It starts to explain the inexplicable. Mm-hmm. How can a team whose goal is to win games, to generate revenue through fan engagement, how is it possible that they're making this kind of decision that seems so inexplicable? How is it possible that you're continuing to hang on to that underperforming employee? Mm-hmm. And that relates to, kind of, I think something else that I think we need to treat with a lot of sensitivity when we talk about behavioral finance and cognitive biases in decision-making is that there is, something that it also comes up called the confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. And that is where you look, in the data for examples that reinforce what you already believe to be true. And if anyone has any questions about this, I direct you to the wide body of research that talks about partisanship and social media, that we tend to create a world which reinforces what we already believe to be true. And this is so prevalent in a way that it even wasn't 5 years ago when I was working on my dissertation. But I also think there's something to really kind of ponder about this in a way that I think is really important, which is that if we don't have confidence in ourselves as decision makers, if you start to doubt your ability to make good decisions, and I don't know if you, Anna, or any of your listeners have had this experience where you really bungled something, and that whatever that's a day or a month or a year afterwards, you second guess yourself. I thought this person was so and what was this? I thought this investment was this. I thought this business decision was this. It's paralyzing. If you don't believe in yourself as a good decision maker, if you lose that confidence, you really can't do much of anything. So we have a lot invested in believing that we're good decision makers. We have a lot invested in thinking that we hold beliefs that are true. I mean, if you walked around with this kind of an epistemology in philosophy, you call it your web of beliefs, and be like, yeah, well, you know, maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. It's very disorienting, right? So we want to believe we're right. We want to believe that we accepted things on the basis of good authority. That's why we have a really high standard for overturning a belief, which is also part of behavioral finance. Too high of a standard, proportionate to the standard we have to accept a belief. Again, moving that framing away from this is all bad and normatively inappropriate and we're foolish, to the fact that it actually makes sense that we're trying to protect our own belief and our own decision-making. And that's why the confirmation bias exists. It's why belief persistence, which is another bias, which is where I'll hold on to a belief, like in Russell Wilson, long after other people would be like, this doesn't make sense, right? The whole camaraderie of like, you know, the whole like blogosphere is like, oh my God. And you're like, no. And that's belief persistence, right? But there's something really important behind that, which is that if I don't trust my own intelligence, I'm really up a creek. So there's obviously you go too far with that. But I think that human recognition there of the fact that this is why people do this, mm-hmm. Is really important for us to be empathic around our own decision-making failures and other people's as well.
And sorry to veer off the course of questions, but I'm curious about like your techniques or recommendations for, because we as professionals, as people, as, you know, spouses, is we lose that decision-making confidence sometimes, you know, and if some of our firm owners, some of our partners, some of our listeners find themselves in that situation, what are some course correcting advice you might have?
It's a really good question. And I think that a lot of your listeners, folks in the financial services industry, they have what we call a strong internal locus of control. And what that means is that, you know, if you were to think about it like a continuum, people with a strong internal locus of control tend to think that they can influence everything, right? So very little about what's happening to me in my life is affected by external events. Most of it is me, right? And that can be a really wonderful way to be, right? It's really empowering. It creates a lot of incentive to act if I think my life and the circumstances of my life are really determined based on my decisions. The challenge with that, though, is that that's usually just not true. We overestimate our locus of control. And really interesting research that's being done on structural racism and structural sexism starts to illuminate the ways in which circumstances are not within the control of the individual, but are larger environmental or system-wide impacts that affect outcomes. So I think one of the things that happens, and kind of to your question about, how would you recenter after a decision-making setback? One of the most powerful things that I have heard, somebody said to me once, I wish they heard me say, and it's that things can go wrong and it cannot be your fault. And that's, you can have made a decision that didn't work out. And it's actually not because you failed, right? It's not, sometimes that external environment is stronger than we understood or knew. And I think it's interesting. I talked to some business owners who started these, you know, very consumer friendly or recreational businesses right before the pandemic. And well, of course they failed. You know, if you opened a restaurant in December of 2019, like that was not going to work for you. And I think we tend to underestimate the way that the external environment can impact outcomes. And so I think there's a, and again, you can go too much to the other side of this, but there's also a moment of humility that comes with that too. Mm-hmm. So when you find yourself kind of paralyzed because you believe that it was your poor decision-making that led to an adverse outcome, and now you kind of feel doubtful of your own decision-making skill, it's always good to kind of check how much of that was ever really in your control in the first place. And I think that if you're able to do that, maybe with a trusted group of friends or advisors or mentors or coaches, that can be really, really impactful to your kind of accurate assessment of what happened.
Love that. I love that. I think our listeners will find that very helpful also. So I'm going to shift a little here. You know, we talked about how you head up the Next Gen initiatives here at Carson, and on another podcast that's wonderful, Standard Deviations with Dr. Daniel Crosby. Y'all were on the show together a few years ago. Love that episode.
Love him.
Yeah, he's great. He's also going to be on this month. So yeah. So, you know, he talked about a little bit how leaders can also implement behavioral finance theory to help them better recruit candidates and make our industry more appealing to a wider variety of people. So I'd love to get your perspective on that.
That everything Daniel says is right. That's usually the perspective I take when I hear Daniel's talked on something, and he'll probably listen to this and laugh. But I mean, I think that incorporating, you know, insights into how human beings make decisions into interviews and recruiting processes is always a really important consideration to offer. One of the central tenets of behavioral finance is that individuals make decisions from a particular place and location, and that we are not fully objective in the way that traditional economic theory would predict. So traditional economic theory would presuppose that rational choice theory would presuppose that you were making a decision about what job you wanted to accept based on a variety of calculations upon which you have perfect information, and that your ability to prioritize and interpret that information is essentially flawless. Now, no one like actually makes decisions like that. But I do think the insight and that ultimately the core difference of behavioral finance, behavioral economics, and traditional economic theory is this insight that human beings, not rational calculators, make decisions. And that would be kind of the vantage point I would come into maybe offering some thoughts on this. When we think about the insight of behavioral finance, which is that it is human decision makers, not rational calculators, and we take that and we apply that to the decision to think through how you're going to structure your recruiting and hiring process, I think you need to land on the fact that you're interviewing individual people with different life histories and different expectations. And for me, as someone who does interview folks and talks to a lot of different students, one of the things I've had to realize very early on is that what motivates and inspires and incentivizes one person, if you know that about one person, you know that about one person. And I think that this industry has gone wrong, deeply wrong, problematically wrong, by assuming that anyone who's going to be successful in this business is going to be motivated by a similar set of your standard box of incentives, right? In this very problematic eat what you kill. I'm motivated by autonomy. That every successful candidate is going to be motivated by autonomy and the potential for endless income. And that's just not true. So I think to the extent that we move away from that rational calculus, people are motivated by, money, right? And only money. And we broaden that out. I think that is, an important place to orient. Although Daniel will say all of this much better than me because he's the expert, but that would be where I think through the question.
No, I love getting your perspective though, because you do are so heavily involved in that next gen and the recruiting and the interviewing and things like that. So Dr. Julie, as we wrap up, you already kind of told us about the things you want people to reframe their thinking on when it comes to this topic. So if people are, kind of pressed for time and kind of half listened to the episode, what are the top two or three takeaways from this episode that you want them to go and be like, look, I can start implementing this today in my practice?
Yeah. I mean, I would, if I could offer one kind of action item that people could do, and then one way of reframing. So in terms of an action item, one thing I think is really helpful, and they do this very effectively in the military, is what they call an after action report. Mm-hmm. And they almost have to do it instantaneously after the incident has occurred, where they do as much as they can as a root cause analysis. And even just a documentation of the sequence of events as quickly as possible to get that all on paper. But the ability and the kind of framework is set up to be somewhat agnostic and dispassionate about the factors that led to that decision in the hopes that you can learn from it. Now, most of us aren't, like when I make a bad decision, like I pout, right? Like I'm not like after action report, like I'm going to go sit and regain my confidence as a decision maker, maybe mainly by blaming other people, right? But I think there's value in sitting with your team and maybe looking back in the last 3 months or so and saying, where was a decision that landed in a way we didn't expect? Mm-hmm. and trying to walk through the factors that led to that decision, the things you might have missed, what assumptions did we get wrong, what information that turned out to be relevant that we didn't know to look for. Mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of really great resources online about how to do these reports, but I think that's really valuable. It's almost the anatomy or dissection of a decision. And I think when you do that, and if you have some experience with behavioral finance, if you have some experience with those concepts, you'll start to see them poke up. Mm-hmm. And for all of us, we're all persuaded mainly by information in our own case. Right. So I'm much more persuaded if I see how this has impacted my decisions than I am if I see how it's impacted on us. So I think that can be really, really powerful. And I think the way I would recommend, you know, as a takeaway to reframe, would just go back to what I shared at the beginning of the episode. We use biases, heuristics in our decision making because of the way that the universe presents so much information to us and that we as decision makers are trying to sort it out. There's nothing wrong with that. And so this is just a way, if we have like an operating manual for our mind, behavioral finance is the map of a mind making decisions in the wild, right? In the universe, in the real environment. And there's, again, that is a normatively neutral thing. And the better you can know your own operating manual, the more kind of easier it is for you to diagnose when things go wrong. So approaching it as this theory is a mind map, not just of Anna, not just of me, not just of really people who are just not smart about finance, not just for members of certain social economic groups, not just for members of certain racial and ethnic groups, not just for women, right? That this is just the way the human mind operates. I think that can be really empowering too.
That's such a valuable takeaway. And I always love it when guests like you can just sum up so succinctly and so like accurately what people need to do and what they can do. So Dr. Julie, is there anything I didn't ask that you'd like to include?
No, but what fun to talk about this. Just thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And I always learn so much. I'm always in awe. You speak so well and just like drop knowledge all the time. So I'm very grateful for you coming on Framework again, getting that jacket. You know, I'm definitely.
What it's all about, Anna. Exactly. No, I just want the jacket.
I think we'll all design it together. You know, me and my.
I love that. I don't want Craig designing it.
No, because he could suggest the green.
Color. You shouldn't be involved in the design part of it.
Well, sorry, Dr. Craig, we're going to have to leave you out. But join us again next week and next month. Dr. Julie and I are going to dive into our Carson 2023 State of Women in Wealth Management report. So if you haven't downloaded that yet, please do and come prepared to learn a little bit more about it next month. And Dr. Julie, thank you again for joining us.
Oh, so fun to be with you. Thanks so much, Anna.
And thank you, everybody else, for tuning into this episode of the Framework Podcast. Please subscribe so you never miss an episode.